Also, in NSC 68, we see the plans to stimulate nationalism, both in the Soviet Union and Eastern Europe, as a way of stimulating and promoting the breakup and dissolution of the Soviet Union. Here again, we can see the genesis or foundation for the policy which was put into effect with the destabilization of the USSR and Eastern Europe, and which ultimately had its fruition in the successful fruition with the dissolution of the Soviet Union and the secession of some of the non-Russian republics. And again, that was the ultimate goal of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations, a key element in the generation of liberation or rollback theory. And we took a look at the role of the ABN and other Galen-related elements in this liberation milieu, this intelligence, petroleum, national security milieu that we looked at in the first two installments of RFA 37. We also took a look at the plans to suppress domestic dissent, the need to, quote, reconcile order and security, the need for participation with the requirements of freedom, unquote. That is an obvious euphemism for domestic repression. And beyond that, we saw that something that was viewed as essential for the successful realization of NSC 68 was, quote, a mass propaganda campaign to, quote, build and maintain confidence on our side and so, quote, mass defections, unquote, on theirs, covert economic, political, and psychological warfare, tighter internal security, and beefed up intelligence. Well, the mass propaganda campaign basically is the CFF operations inside of the United States, which resulted in this profound evolution of a Third Reich psychological and political warfare technique and theory into the evolution of a dominant American, element of American political and strategic thinking in the post-World War II period. And what we're looking at with NSC 68 is the economic and political rationale, the economic and political context in which the Galen organization was able to function, because obviously the scare tactics that the Galen org generated vis-a-vis its exaggerations of the Soviet intentions and capabilities, and the translation of Galen / Third Reich political thinking into American society as a result of the CFF and its role in the genesis of rollback or liberation theory, these served the needs of the American political and economic planners behind NSC 68, such as Paul Nitze, to, quote, scare the American people, to propagandize them in such a way as to make them receptive to the enormous military spending. And here again, we are looking at the political and economic context in the political and economic forces in the context of the Christian West concept. Again, Third Reich concept evolves into NATO and the economic cooperation between member nations. The Christian West concept ultimately is the context in which the Galen organization was able to begin to exert the profound effect on American and world society that it exerted precisely as a result of its interaction with some of the political and economic forces that we've looked at in NSC 68 and that we will be looking at in great detail and at considerable length this evening. And again, I want to emphasize that we should not look at the Galen organization. Again, a Trojan horse in the United States is operating in a vacuum. It did represent the vehicle, in my opinion, and I think I can back that up rather substantially during the course of this broadcast when we see its resolution. It did serve as the vehicle for the conquest of the United States, for, in essence, the victory of the Third Reich. Many years after the formal conclusions of World War II, the formal conclusion of World War II, but it did so by turning around the von Clausewitz principle. Again, von Clausewitz said, war is the continuation of politics by other means. What we're looking at is politics as the continuation of war by other means. We're going to turn again to the book Blowback, and we're going to take a look at the Eisenhower administration. And again, review a short passage that we looked at last week. And even though liberation theory, liberation approach, rollback theory became a major component of the 1952 presidential or electoral campaigns, both at the presidential and congressional level, and even though veteran U.S. intelligencer John Frenchie Grombach, Grombach, exerted tremendous pressure through Joe McCarthy and a Nazi intelligence network that had freelanced for, worked on contract for John Grombach on behalf of the CIA and State Department, and then worked privately on behalf of Grombach and McCarthy to provide dirt on Eisenhower appointees, this by way of driving Eisenhower administration policies in the direction promoted by, or desired, I should say, by Joe McCarthy and related elements. Eisenhower, in spite of all of this, remained basically devoted politically to containment rather than rollback theory. Christopher Simpson describes that as follows in the book Blowback. But despite the Republicans' public attacks on Truman's containment policy, Eisenhower's election had been a victory for the Republican establishment, not for the radical right. The Republicans did not have a substantially new strategy for dealing with the Soviets beyond a tendency to use harsher rhetoric than the Democrats. George Kennan's containment theories may have seemed like part of the problem to most liberation advocates, but his thinking on clandestine political warfare against the Soviets was most welcome to Eisenhower and dominated the scene at the Solarium strategy conferences. Eisenhower himself personally endorsed Kennan's stratagems, his analysis of East-West affairs, and the former diplomat himself. So obviously, as we've seen, the Eisenhower administration, for all of the liberation rhetoric, did not basically adopt liberation theory for all of the impetus, did all of the pressure upon it to do that. What we're going to take a look at now, in again turning to the book Blowback, is a further view of the evolution of rollback or liberation theory and the rollback or liberation milieu, which we saw taking power by force of arms on November 22, 1963 in Dallas, Texas, with the assassination of John Kennedy. And we're going to be going to look at now the momentum built up by the rollback or liberation theory and the events leading immediately up to the successful coup of November 22, 1963. Christopher Simpson writes in Blowback, by the way, the ACEN that you're going to be hearing about here is the Assembly of Captive European Nations. That is another CIA-financed and CIA-operated group. Simpson writes, the government-financed ACEN and its partially interlocked ally, the anti-Bolshevik nations, gradually coalesced into a faction of the far-right wing of the Republican and, to a lesser degree, Democratic parties. By 1960, this captive nations movement had used the support it enjoyed in the media and in conservative circles to garner a measure of real power. Its annual parade committee in New York that year was endorsed by 84 senators and congressmen. Conservative heavyweights such as William F. Buckley Jr., Sidney Hook, and Fred Schlafly, S-C-H-L-A-F-L-Y, openly promoted the event. By the way, Fred Schlafly, of course, is the husband of Phyllis Schlafly, the anti-ERA activist, whose sainted visage we saw on our television screens during the recent Republican convention. Continuing. Scores of ethnic leaders, including a number of Jewish notables, mobilized for the march. The political tone, of course, was thoroughly patriotic, pro-American, and anti-communist. Nevertheless, side by side with the careful politicians on the rostrum were open apologists for Nazi genocide. One of the key organizers of the 1960 event, for example, was Austin App, APP, a cheerful American of German descent whose books History's Most Terrifying Peace and later The 6 Million Swindle are considered the foundation of the, quote, Holocaust Never Happened, unquote, school of historical revisionism. Captive Nations activists became dedicated foot soldiers in just about every right-wing crusade undertaken in the United States during the 1950s and 60s. They turned out hundreds of demonstrators to pelt Soviet diplomats with eggs and garbage during the official celebration of the 40th anniversary of the 1917 Revolution, for example, picketed department stores that carried goods made in Eastern Europe, and disrupted local school board meetings with charges that small-town principals and the PTA had gone communist. Captive Nations activists succeeded in purging libraries in some jurisdictions of books they considered insufficiently hostile to the USSR. Equally important, Captive Nations lobbyists on Capitol Hill began to play a small but real role in American foreign affairs. They could not, of course, write U.S. policy. But working together with corporate finance lobbies such as the Pro-Armament American Security Council, captive nations' leaders have acted as influential spoilers capable of obstructing important East-West peace initiatives undertaken by both Republican and Democratic administrations. They continue, in fact, to play that role today. Interrupting, of course, the American Security Council is a key element of the World Anti-Communist League. Its genesis was Harry Jung's American Vigilant Intelligence Federation, which collaborated with the Hitler Goebbels Anti-Comintern in the 1930s. And recall that in our second and third installment of this archive show, we saw that one of the major strategic plans of the Third Reich for going underground was to hook up with American fascist groups. And the American Security Council was very active on behalf of the anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations agenda, demonstrating to a certain extent at least the successful realization of that tactic as envisioned by Kurt Rees in The Nazis Go Underground in 1944. And in our second installment, we took a look at the American Security Council and how it played a key role in helping to advance the agenda of the ABN. Continuing here with Blowback. It is a common and long-standing phenomenon of American political life, unquote, George Kenan wrote some years later of his experience with captive nations activists, again quoting, that ethnic groups of this nature, representing compact voting groups in large cities, are often able to bring to bear on individual legislators and through them on the United States government an influence far greater than an equivalent group of native citizens would be able to exert, unquote. As early as July 1959, the U.S. Congress unanimously adopted a resolution calling for an annual Captive Nations Week. The CIA-funded ACEN, quote, strongly promoted, unquote, the resolution on Capitol Hill, according to Senator Charles Mathias of Maryland, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. Last sentence again, and it's a key one. By the way, note the time frame here. This is July of 1959. As early as July of 1959, the U.S. Congress unanimously adopted a resolution calling for an annual Captive Nations Week. The CIA-funded ACEN, quote, strongly promoted, unquote, the resolution on Capitol Hill, according to Senator Charles Mathias of Maryland, a member of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee. The use of CIA funds to lobby Congress, it should be noted, is a specific violation of law. The openly pro-Axis ABN also backed the bill and succeeded in introducing language into the text of the resolution calling for freedom for such, quote, nations, unquote, as Kosakia and Idel Ural, both of which are fictitious entities created as a propaganda ploy by Hitler's racial theoretician Alfred Rosenberg during World War II. The congressional pronouncement also called for, in effect, the dismemberment of the USSR through, quote, freeing, unquote, the Ukraine, Georgia, and Belarusia from Soviet captivity. Last couple of sentences again, and I think here we can see in very clear and dramatic fashion how this Third Reich political and psychological warfare technique or tactic of liberation ultimately has evolved into a major American political force. And as we jump ahead from 1959 to 1991 and 1992, we can see that, quote, the dismemberment of the USSR through, quote, freeing, unquote, the Ukraine, Georgia, and Belarusia from Soviet captivity has happened. Those nations are now independent. We'll touch back on that next week. We went into that in a big way in Radio Free America 36. Last two sentences again. The openly pro-Axis ABN also backed the bill and succeeded in introducing language into the text of the resolution calling for freedom for such, quote, nations, unquote, as Kosakia and Idel Ural, Kosakia and Idel-Ural, both of which are fictitious entities created as a propaganda ploy by Hitler's racial theoretician Alfred Rosenberg during World War II. The congressional pronouncement also called for, in effect, the dismemberment of the USSR through, quote, freeing, unquote, the Ukraine, Georgia, and Belarusia from Soviet captivity. Simpson goes on, the resolution was, quote, churned out, unquote, of Congress, according to a columnist of the day, quote, along with casual holiday proclamations such as National Hot Dog Month, unquote. Yet the timing of the proclamation was significant, and it constituted a major victory for hardline captive nations organizers. Vice President Richard Nixon, hardly a liberal on the question of communism, was then in Moscow on a major Republican effort to improve East-West communication and stabilize the nuclear arms race. Soviet Premier Khrushchev took exception to the unanimously passed congressional statement calling for the disintegration of his country and used the incident to raise questions about American sincerity in the negotiations. Nixon was forced to explain and, in effect, apologize for the U.S. Congress, pointing out that even President Eisenhower did not control the timing of congressional acts. Quote, neither the president nor I would have deliberately chosen to have a resolution of this type passed, unquote, Nixon said soothingly, again quoting, just before we were to visit the USSR, unquote. The damage, however, had already been done. So let's pause to look at what we've seen so far in this section of Simpson's blowback. Basically, just as we looked at the CFF, promoting liberation theory in American society, the CFF, a CIA organization. So we see the CIA-funded ACEN evolving from that and evolving into a major American political force, and evolving up through time-wise the 1960, the turn of that decade. The captive nations activists, as noted here by Simpson, became foot soldiers in just about every far-right crusade conducted in the United States, and more importantly, in part as a result of their ability to influence some of the ethnic voting blocs in American major cities, which were able to exert a disproportionate effect on American political life. And recall that boosting some of these Galen-related elements into positions of leadership in such groups was a major function of the CIA-CFF propaganda program undertaken as a result of, in conjunction with NSC 68 by Paul Nitze, that one of the goals of this program, the CFF propaganda campaign, was to boost leaders of Galen-related elements into the leadership of some of these groups. Now, one of the most important things here is to note that by 1959, when Richard Nixon was visiting the Soviet Union and attempting to work out a certain degree of rapprochement vis-a-vis arms control, we find the U.S. Congress passing a resolution as a result of lobbying by the CIA-funded ACEN, an illegal undertaking. We find the Congress passing a resolution which ultimately, in which we can ultimately see the evolution of liberation theory from its Third Reich incarnation to the present major American and world political force that it became. And as a result of advocating the dismemberment of the Soviet Union, including the fictitious nations of Kazakhia and Idel Ural, specific propaganda ploys created by the Third Reich, we find Richard Nixon having his attempts on behalf of the Eisenhower administration to achieve to stabilize the nuclear arms race, we find Richard Nixon's efforts being frustrated as a result of political activity, which is undertaken as the ultimate result of, again, domestic CIA operation through the ACEN in conjunction with what is accurately described here as the openly pro-Axis anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations. There are many other archive shows which should be utilized in order to fully comprehend the sweep of events that we're looking at in Radio Free America 37, and in particular in The Guns of November Part 1, which I recorded on November 1st of 1983, almost 10 years ago at this point. We took a look at the downing of the U-2 in May, specifically May 1st of 1960, and how that particular event helped to frustrate. It actually caused the cancellation of a summit conference between then-President Eisenhower and then-Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev. And specifically, we took a look at very firm indications from Colonel L. Fletcher Prouty's book, The Secret Team, that the dispatching of that particular U-2 flight and its downing were as a result of illegal covert operations by elements of the national security establishment. Fletcher Prouty was at the time alternately Air Force focal point officer, that is to say he was the Air Force officer involved with coordinating and liaisoning with the CIA vis-a-vis CIA covert operations that required the use of air units. He also became, under President Kennedy's administration, the Joint Chiefs of Staff person. He was in charge of special operations for the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Now, in the Guns of November, we went into Prouty's analysis, an individual who had a first-hand perspective on that, of the U-2 incident. Recall also last week that we took a look at how the disinformation generated not only by the Galen Organization, but also by some of the Project Paperclip rocket scientists, such as General Walter Dornberger, who was the military commander of the Nazi rocket project at Peenemünde Nordhausen, how the U-2 played an important element in attempting to find out whether the Soviets, as reported by Galen and Paperclip elements, were indeed far ahead of the U.S. Vis-a-vis ICBM development. Closing the missile gap, by the way, was a major campaign theme of President John Kennedy's 1960 presidential campaign. And as we looked at last week, the U-2 flights over the Soviet Union were being dispatched to surveil Soviet rail capabilities to see whether they were, in fact, as reported by Galen and Dornberger and company, ahead of the U.S. in missile development and deploying ICBMs, and that also turned out to be complete BS. The U-2 flights, the U-2, of course, a very sophisticated spy plane developed by the United States, the U-2 flights ultimately led to the deep sixing of this summit conference between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Now, the things that Prouty points out, first of all, Eisenhower himself had suspended all U-2 overflights of the Soviet Union so as not to risk the possibility of aggravating tensions between those two countries. One of the points Prouty makes is that the very dispatching of Power's plane was against President Eisenhower's orders. He also makes an excellent case that, in fact, the plane itself was sabotaged and not actually brought down by a Soviet missile. The damage to the plane was not consistent with having been shot down by a surface-to-air missile. And beyond that, at the time, no surface-to-air missile or interceptor aircraft was capable of flying at the high altitudes that the U-2 was flying at, because the U-2 used a special oxygen mixture. It was mixed with, I've forgotten off the top of my head what it was an oxygen hydrogen mixture, and ultimately the evidence suggests, and for details I will refer listeners to the Guns of November Part 1, available from archives on audio. The available evidence suggests very strongly, and Prouty makes a very detailed and excellent case, that in fact the very same forces which illegally dispatched the U-2 or dispatched the U-2 flight of Francis Gary Powers to the Soviet Union against Eisenhower's orders deliberately sabotaged that flight, in all probability starving its oxygen mixture to the point where the plane had to fly at a lower altitude. It has also been theorized by some that the plane might have run out of fuel, but as Prouty points out, the very thin wings of the U-2 would easily reveal whether or not the plane was low on fuel, because they bent when the wings bent when the plane had a sufficiently full fuel capability. Now, the interesting thing about the dispatching, the illegal dispatching and sabotaging of the U-2, and again, I refer listeners for details to the Guns of November Part 1, the interesting thing about that is that the blame on the part of many people was placed for the downing of the U-2 project on Lee Harvey Oswald. Lee Harvey Oswald had worked with the U-2 project at Atsugi Naval Air Station in Japan. He then, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union, allegedly giving them top secret information about the U-2 as well as America's North American radar defense nets. And Francis Gary Powers, the pilot who was captured in when his U-2 was brought down, blamed the downing of the U-2 on Lee Harvey Oswald. And specifically, we quoted from the book Operation Overflight, which Francis Gary Powers co-authored with Kurt Gentry. Another point, by the way, that Powers Prouty makes is that it was standard operating procedure to have a pilot on a clandestine mission such as the U-2 mission totally sanitized. He would not have carried any official documentation linking him to the U.S. government. Francis Gary Powers, in direct contravention of that standard operating procedure, had all of his U.S. government, U.S. Air Force ID on him, yet another indication that that was a deliberately deep-sixed operation, an operation, a covert operation, undertaken by elements of our national security establishment sympathetic to the rollback or liberation theory, and who found Eisenhower's prospective rapprochement with Khrushchev totally unacceptable. There is substantive indication that indeed the political and psychological warfare being waged in the U.S. under the auspices of CFF and ACEN had evolved by the end of Eisenhower's administration to the actual use of hands-on covert operation, illegal covert operations, in order to achieve political ends which were desired by the rollback or liberation people and which were in direct contravention of what the Eisenhower administration was undertaking. And recall again that the CIA-financed ACEN campaign to get the Captive Nations Week resolution passed, incorporating anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations and Third Reich elements, that helped frustrate Richard Nixon's attempts to achieve détente on behalf of Eisenhower in July of 1959. And again, Lee Harvey Oswald was credited with having deep-sixed the U-2 of Francis Gary Powers, both by Francis Gary Powers and others, as we looked at in The Guns of November, Part 1. And as I noted in that program, look at all of the history that's being blamed on this lone nut. The murder of the President of the United States, the deep-sixing of the summit conference, not bad for a warehouse worker with an eighth-grade education under the circumstances. What we're going to look at now is information indicating the possibility, we can't say for sure, but the possibility that even before John Kennedy was elected, the advocates in our national security establishment of rollback or liberation theory were prepared to up the ante, so to speak, vis-a-vis covert operations in order to achieve their ends, and specifically that preparations may have been afoot even before Eisenhower was elected, or before Kennedy was elected, I should say, to, if necessary, assassinate the President of the United States in order to realize the goals or further the goals of rollback or liberation. Recall that in the second installment of Radio Free America 37, as well as in Radio Free America 15, we took a look at the fact that on October 15th, 1959, two events happened. One, Lee Harvey Oswald, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union, and Stefan Bandera, a key element of the Third Reich's policies in the Ukraine, the OUNB group, as well as a key element of the CIA-sponsored Galen organization in the post-war years, Stefan Bandera, the leader of this organization, was assassinated, supposedly by the KGB, the same day that Lee Harvey Oswald, quote, defected, unquote, to the Soviet Union, namely 10-15-59. And as we saw in, again, both Radio Free America 15 and the second installment of Radio Free America 37, the Bandera assassination, supposedly at the hands of the KGB, was utilized by this Galen-related milieu, the WACCFL and the ABN and related elements on the American far right and in the U.S. intelligence system. It was used to create the myth or to generate the impression that Lee Harvey Oswald was acting on behalf of the KGB to assassinate John Kennedy. Specifically, we looked at Charles Kirsten, a U.S. congressman and key WACCFL representative, who was generating information about a KGB assassination conspiracy to, or assassination conspiracies to be conducted in the United States 2 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated. After Kennedy was assassinated, we took a look at the role of the press secretary for the WACCFL, again, the seed group of the World Anti-Communist League, or what became the World Anti-Communist League in 1967. The WACCFL was the World Anti-Communist Congress for Freedom and Liberation. We took a look at the role of Salvador Diaz-Verson, a Cuban intelligence official and head of the Liga Anticomunista de Cuba, in linking Lee Harvey Oswald to Castro and through Castro to the KGB. We also took a look in that same program at Peter Dale Scott, the brilliant Berkeley researcher's analysis that many people, that participants in the investigation of John Kennedy's assassination who knew that there had been a conspiracy affected the cover-up because they did not want to risk having a third world war if the American people perceived that an American president had been assassinated by an international communist conspiracy. And Peter Dale Scott hypothesizes that that was one of the motivating factors on behalf of some of the investigators, Warren Commission and otherwise, for covering up the assassination of John, or the facts concerning the assassination of John Kennedy. What we're going to look at now is a curious detail presented to us by Penn Jones of the Midlothian Mirror. He was an editor of the Midlothian Mirror, and that is a suburb of Dallas, and Penn Jones was one of the seminal researchers on the John Kennedy assassination. And we're going to take a look at an interesting piece of evidence he presents suggesting the possibility, again, that plans were afoot in 1959 to kill the president to be elected in 1960 if that president was not willing to fulfill the anti-communist / rollback liberation goals that were envisioned by the milieu whose evolution and development we're looking at this evening. For this information, we're going to take a look at a book called Forgive My Grief, Volume 4. And Forgive My Grief, Volume 4 was privately published in software, actually published by the Midlothian Mirror. And no, this one was published and copyrighted 1974 by Penn Jones Jr. of Midlothian, Texas. This was a privately published soft cover edition, copyright 1974 by Penn Jones Jr. Again, the title, Forgive My Grief, Volume 4. In a detail here from August 29th of 1974 that Penn Jones entitles Prior Planning, we find the following. Now, before I read this, bear in mind the name Katia Ford. Katia Ford and her husband, Declan Ford, part of this white Russian petroleum industry, Galen-related milieu, of which George Bush was part and parcel. Katia Ford was the wife, again, of Declan Ford. Declan Ford, up until October of 1962, was an employee of DeGolyer and McNaughton, a key petroleum engineering firm, many of whose employees, former employees and associates, were prominent in this Galen intelligence petroleum industry milieu that we looked at, this liberation or rollback milieu, which we looked at in our first two installments of Radio Free America 37. And by the way, bear in mind Declan Ford, Katia Ford, and in particular, bear in mind the DeGolyer and McNaughton firm, because we're going to come back to that later. Now, in this item here, entitled By Penn Jones Prior Planning, we find the following. In 1959, three American men defected to the Soviet Union. A man named Ricardelli, Robert Edward Webster, and Lee Harvey Oswald, and all three returned to the United States in 1962. Katia Ford testified that when she asked Marina Oswald what caused Lee to go to Russia, Marina said Lee went to the Soviet Union for the RAND Corporation to help set up the American exhibit at the World Trade Exposition in Moscow. Obviously, Marina had her, quote, defectors, unquote, confused. RAND Corporation was the cover story used by Robert Edward Webster. Were the masterminds behind the John Kennedy assassination preparing three potential patsies, two as backup in the event one failed to perform as directed? Did the stars ordain the 1959 defections and the 1962 repatriations? Or was prior planning for the killing of Kennedy really going on in 1959? Well, again, we can't say for sure whether prior planning was going on, but there are indications that it may have been, with the downing of the U-2 against Eisenhower's wishes. Its dispatching and the strange circumstances of its downing, that blamed on Lee Harvey Oswald, that frustrating Eisenhower efforts at detente with the Soviet Union, just as the CIA-ACEN passing of the Captive Nations Week resolution helped to do the same thing. There are indications that even before Kennedy was elected, that the rollback or liberation milieu was prepared to graduate from political and psychological warfare to the use of actual hands-on covert operations and the use of deadly force in case the 1960 president-elect was not sufficiently vigorous in his prosecution of the Cold War. And again, bear in mind, Declan Ford and his wife Katya Ford and de Gaulle and McNaughton, we're going to come back to that later. And also, take note of the fact that this is according to Katya Ford, that Marina said that, as we will see as we return to the operations of this Galen petroleum-related milieu. What Marina said and what she supposedly said and what she actually said are often two different things, and this rollback or liberation milieu, which we've been looking at, was deeply involved in distorting what Marina said, and distorting it in such a way as to make it look like the Soviet Union was behind the assassination of John Kennedy. Now, as we've seen, the rollback or liberation milieu was deeply dissatisfied with the Eisenhower administration, which, despite the pressure on it and its commitment to rollback or liberation in the 52 campaign, was basically an advocate of containment. There were a great many things that John Kennedy did which not only did not commit to rollback or liberation theory, but which in fact were moving in the direction of ending the Cold War. It should be noted that this rollback or liberation milieu that we're looking at considered Eisenhower to be distinctly pink. They viewed John Kennedy as an absolute card-carrying red, and we're going to take a look at what Kennedy was doing, what he did, to outrage the rollback or liberation milieu, not only the national security establishment, but the political and economic forces behind it. We're going to turn again to a short section of an article in Tikkun magazine, T-I-K-K-U-N. This is from Tikkun's issue of March and April of 1992. Research credit on this goes to a listener, and this is an interview with Berkeley professor Peter Dale Scott by Tikkun magazine. It's entitled "The Assassination and the Cover-Up: What Really Happened." Now, in the Guns of November series, we went into many of the things that Kennedy had done to outrage the national security establishment. I'm going to go into those in a second, but it should be noted here that there's something in this particular article, this interview with Peter Dale Scott, which I was not aware of before. Reading from Tikkun, and also policy in Latin America. There had been three military coups in Latin America in 1963, in Guatemala, the Dominican Republic, and Honduras, but Kennedy had refused to recognize the new governments. And that obviously is one of the things that Kennedy had done to outrage the national security establishment. Those coups were assisted by the U.S. intelligence system. But going back to the things that Kennedy did to outrage the national security establishment. In the first place, vis-a-vis Cuba, in 1961, President Kennedy refused to dispatch the Air Force to support the Bay of Pigs invasion. This greatly outraged the national security establishment. And in 1962, he refused to either bomb or invade Cuba during the Cuban Missile Crisis, which the military wanted. That outraged the national security establishment. And finally, in 1963, as we looked at in Radio Free America number 12, Kennedy had worked out a backdoor diplomatic channel to Cuba and was affecting basically a normalization of relations. Basically, a quid pro quo was being worked out between Kennedy and Castro. Castro, although a Marxist, was, like Ho Chi Minh, primarily a Cuban nationalist, and being a realist, he understood that the best long-term interests for Cuba lay in a friendly relationship with the giant to the north. Kennedy was intent on wooing Cuba away from the Soviet Union, and Castro himself had decided, at least according to the people directly involved in the negotiations and Castro himself, to begin moving away from the international communists in his own circle, notably Che Guevara. Now, what the rapprochement was going to entail was that Kennedy would take responsibility on behalf of the United States for the brutal Batista dictatorship, and in return, Castro would move away from the Soviet orbit. Numerous Kennedy administration diplomats, including William Atwood, have confirmed this, and on the 20th anniversary of John Kennedy's assassination, Castro himself confirmed that. I note this because there are a number of so-called progressive political analysts and commentators who shall remain nameless under the circumstances who have taken issue with this. Note that not only Kennedy administration diplomats directly involved with this, but also Fidel Castro himself have confirmed this. Rather reliable sources under the circumstances. In fact, Castro himself, as discussed in the book Conspiracy by Anthony Summers, Castro himself, which we quoted in Radio Free America number 12, Castro was actually meeting with a French journalist named Jean Daniel, who was serving as a backdoor diplomatic representative for Kennedy when he heard that Kennedy had been assassinated, and Castro commented, es una mala noticia, this is bad news. Now, vis-a-vis the Soviet Union, John Kennedy had done a number of things in the direction of détente, which outraged the national security establishment and the rollback or liberation milieu. In March of 1962, Kennedy proposed joint space exploration with the Soviet Union. He, in August of 1963, signed the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, the first substantive strategic arms limitation agreement between the U.S. and the USSR. That was bitterly opposed by the military. And he also, in early 1963, had begun a formal process of warming of the Cold War, not heating it up, but thawing of the Cold War would be a better term. Kennedy had, in a speech at American University, taken note of the heroic Soviet role in World War II, and that speech was viewed as a major, major step by the Soviet government. And again, the proposal of joint space exploration with the Soviet Union, signing of the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, and his opening up of the possibility of détente in his American University speech from the spring of 63, all were steps which obviously would greatly outrage the rollback or liberation milieu. Perhaps most significantly, Kennedy, as we looked at in the Guns of November Part 3, Kennedy had worked out a plan to withdraw the U.S. from Vietnam gradually. Initially, 1,000 personnel were going to be withdrawn by Christmas of 1963. All of the forces were going to be gone by, officially at least, some 17,000 advisors by Christmas of 1965. That was formalized in National Security Action Memorandum 263, and National Security Action Memorandum 273 completely turned that around. Again, we went into that in a big, big way in the Guns of November Part 3. So with regard to Cuba, refusing to provide the Air Force to support the Bay of Pigs, and refusing to bomb or invade during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and finally working out a diplomatic rapprochement with Cuba, he outraged not only the national security establishment and the liberation milieu, but powerful corporate interests and political interests, related political interests that lay behind them. Policy of détente with the Soviet Union, joint space exploration, the Atmospheric Test Ban Treaty, and the speech he made at American University